Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore, and streaming live online to every place through WYPR.org. Wherever you're listening from today, we thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Globalization had already been well underway by the time the internet came along, which exponentially accelerated the process. Now, more than ever, the world is a shrinking place in which communications and transactions between countries is as easy as communicating with your next-door neighbor. Knowledge spreads with a click of a mouse or a tap on a tablet at speeds once incomprehensible. With a global workforce, multiculturalism in the business community has been growing. But my guest this hour believes that there is still a resistance to foreigners in the American corporate class. Asen Rashid, president and CEO of DDG, that's a design and architectural firm based here in Baltimore, continually struggled against varying degrees of racial discrimination when climbing the ladder at his company. In a speech at an international symposium on cultural diplomacy held right here in Baltimore, Mr. Rashid described the prejudices he faced as a hardworking Pakistani immigrant in an American and mostly Caucasian company. Beyond hurting feelings, Mr. Rashid believes that American companies are hurting their profit margins by not making a concerted effort to embrace multiculturalism. He joins us now to tell us about his experiences with discrimination and how American companies would be better served by eliminating cultural biases. If you'd like to join our conversation, if any of this rings a bell with you in your own experiences, we'd like to hear from you. Midday's phone lines are 410-662-8780. The toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And our email address for comments and questions that way, midday@wypr.org. Asen Rashid, nice to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. It's a privilege, and I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your company first. Our listeners here in Baltimore and Maryland may not be aware of DDG. It's been around for a while. Tell us about it.
Yes, thank you. DDG, as we call it, is the best-kept secret out of Baltimore. We are originally a company which started in South Africa. Our first office was in Johannesburg. In 1972, it was established. The original founders were South African and Canadian citizen. And when the apartheid started to take a really serious matter in South Africa, so the founders decided to exit out of South Africa for a lot of reasons. And the headquarters at that time was formed in Toronto. And Baltimore was started as a branch office, and the third office, which was a branch office, started in London. So Baltimore, the original founder had some contacts with Rouse Company, so that is how we initially fed the work. And the small office was set up in Columbia for a very short while, and then the decision was made to make the real office in Baltimore, and that was in 1976. Hmm. We got the official U.S. registration for the company.
DDG Architectural and Design Firm, now located out in Canton on 3700 O'Donnell Street, right?
Correct.
What's the building that you're in there?
We are part of the Brewers Hill complex, and this is the building we have. There's a lot of fun stories attached with it. This is the building where Natty Bo was actually brewed. So out of the central area of the building we have is, we call it we created like a very gathering place. We call it Central Park. And that is the area where we have old pictures from the developer, and that's how they used to can and bottle. Mm-hmm. And that was the last assembly line before it goes to the delivery trucks to go out of the road. So this was the Natty Bo building, where we are.
And DDG has how many employees internationally and based in Baltimore?
DDG, Development Design Group, as is abbreviated with, we have around 60 employees at the moment in Baltimore. And we have, in an interesting way, I'll tell you, we don't have any other true-to-the-form branch offices. And there's a reason behind it, and I'll tell you, it's an interesting story. We are a pure design firm. I mean, this is an example of a very diverse but very uniquely business model, which In my life, I've been in the practice for more than 30 years. I have not seen anywhere globally. And that is a very unique. We keep a single high excellence design studio. We provide services to our client. We have been in business, as I say, more than 40 years, 42 years. And we have practiced in more than 53 countries. And we are still growing that. And my objective is, as a CEO, I wanted to work in and practice globally in more than all the 200 countries which are a member of United Nations. And recently we have, the newest country we have agreed with and signed contract is a kind of a sensitive, and we haven't done a press release on, is Iraq. We have been approached by a very progressive developer out of Kurdistan, and I traveled there 3-4 times already, and we are working on two very progressive, very large projects in Kurdistan, in Erbil. So along with that, you know, I enjoy building a practice where we all could be proud of. It is not a simple brick-and-mortar architectural company. It's a lot more than that.
When did you come into the company? I mentioned here that you were born in Pakistan. You came to the United States. I assume your education was here in the United States in architecture?
Yes. I have come and gone out of the United States a multiple time. I got my bachelor's degree in 1983. After that, I went back to Pakistan. I was working there in a design company. And then I decided to come back to take higher education. So I returned back in 1986 and went to University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And after that, I graduated.
Quite a climate change for you from Pakistan to Minnesota, I would
bet. Yes. Yeah. We're basically coming from a 100 degree above to a 110 degrees below.
Right.
And you walk to the campus, and if you're lucky, if you can feel your ears and your nose, you know, and that was one of the reasons I was not kidding when I said that. So I decided that I'm never going to try to look for a job in Minneapolis because I would be lucky if I survived that climate.
Well, how did you end up in Baltimore?
When I was graduating, I was finishing up my grad thesis, and there was two of the representative of DDG, and one of them was an ex-graduate of University of Minnesota School of Architecture. He traveled, and they were trying to pick up, you know, the graduate class to interview. So I signed up for the interview, and I interviewed with them along with another one or two companies at the same time, and to my very big surprise, a week later, I got an offer letter. And I told them very clearly that I'm a foreign student. I am carrying a Pakistani passport and a student visa. And if they pick me, they have to do some extra work because they got to be going through some process to sponsor me. And they were brave, and I was very eager, and they given me a job offer. And I moved to Baltimore, packed my suitcase, and came over.
You came to Baltimore in 1987, am I right?
Yes.
And landed at Development Design Group, or DDG.
Yes.
Now, so it's how many years later now? It's
27 years.
27 years later. Yeah. And you gave a speech about your experiences in that company, moving up through that company to the point where you became its CEO.
Correct.
A partner and then CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And before you tell us about those experiences, because we're going to take our first break here in a moment, I just wonder what brought you at this moment in time to want to address these issues in the form of a speech to this international symposium?
It was just an opportunity. I was approached by Mark Donfeld, who is the CEO and president of this organization, which is stationed out of Berlin. And they just basically was a, I would say, accidental coincidence, and nothing more than that. And they approached us, and they said they're doing a symposium, and if you wanted to be part. And I said, sure, and they have a few topics.
But you chose to tell about your experiences with prejudice and discrimination as you move through this corporate culture.
Yeah, it's a subject which is very near and dear to my heart. And the more I travel overseas, the more I see how many opportunities are out there globally, which we are missing. I mean, the world has changed. The world is constantly changing, as you mentioned earlier. It's a global structure now. It's a global atmosphere. We are not living in a Cold War era that we have partitions, but there are mental barriers still exist. And that is, in my opinion, tremendously hurting economically our growth in the world economy. As how U.S. companies are not taking advantage of the opportunity which they can to create more jobs and more tax base, and especially a city like Baltimore, where we are missing the opportunities. And there are companies outside of USA who are gaining by our stand on such positions. And I think this is, people may not take it seriously today, but this thing is going to hurt us if we don't change our point of views.
That's the message you wanted to send, that it's actually hurting our business atmosphere, our economy, our commerce.
Our commerce is seriously hurting it. And that is what I see and sense, and I feel strong enough that I like to, you know, raise my voice about it in my way and see if hopefully somebody will listen.
And Mr. Rashid, you're talking about today's world. Your own experience goes back to 1987, and you're going to tell us that some of this story as we move along through this hour. But you're describing present conditions. You think this is still very much the case.
Very much the case.
Yeah. When you got to Baltimore, you were recruited to Baltimore.
Exactly.
So this company wanted you there. Did you feel wanted when you arrived and went to work at DDG?
Yes, at the first introduction, absolutely, because they needed to want me enough to become my sponsor.
Right.
As per U.S. immigration regulations, you know, when a foreign student gets a job, there's a process which takes place because every graduate has the opportunity to apply what is called, known in the immigration language, optional practical training, OPT. So that visa, which is my student visa, which is called an F-1 visa, gets a one-year rider by the international office in a campus to get an OPT. And you have to find an employer who is willing to so-called get you in. So the company was very interested, and that is what I feel very wanted. And as you know, you're young with the bright eyes and have a lot of ambitions, and so you want to make the difference in the world, and that is what I came in here.
Well, what was your experience in that company? You know, you noticed in my introduction here, I said this is a very American, mostly Caucasian company that you were moving into. So how did you feel as you went about your daily work?
It was very interesting, very good, actually. When the company was established, people knew about the company. I was the employee number 17 at that time. We were a small company.
Mm-hmm.
We were in Charles Street office at that time. And I was intrigued, and nothing is going to stop me to conquer the world. You know, it's just one of those things. And I start to sense slowly, you know, depending on the hierarchy. I mean, I was a junior intern. I mean, for heaven's sake, I was not the boss, and I was not expecting anything. And I was just there for an experience. I wasn't really sure if I'm going to be here for too long, and I was on a student visa. But slowly and surely, I started to sense a little bit of a nudge, as you can call it, or sense and look in a touch and look in the eyes, what kind of projects you're getting engaged in, what kind of assignment you're getting. And I felt like that, you know, my assignments and my thing was a little bit different than some of the other colleagues, you know, that the deadlines coming my way were different than I need to be putting in 80, 90 hours a week. I don't really mind. I mean, I enjoy working and I love that was always my parents told me, and that's what to me I enjoy because I'd like to feel accomplished. I'm not one of those people who said, I got to go home at 5:30 because I got to have a dinner. And it was never really, and it's still not the issue. And, but I start to sense that there was a difference. And the deadline, which I need to do, was due yesterday, you know, as they say it. And
And that wasn't the case with your peers there in terms of the amount of time they had been at the company?
No.
Okay. So it became clear to you that there was, after a while, you were being treated differently.
Yes.
Were there any comments made about the fact that you were born in another country?
Here and there, in a nutshell. I mean, people used to make fun of how I speak, and they still do. You know, mm-hmm. I speak differently, and I don't have even, I am who I am, you know. And so, you know, it was, I don't know, it was derogatory, but I never really let them get to me because it's, I wanted to be, you know, learning what I came in to learn.
Okay.
I mean, it was architecture. It was nothing about anything else. And so I kept my, you know, mind straight and see, let's keep going.
Would you say that things came to a head in terms of this, in terms of how you felt about prejudice in this particular workplace, when there came an opportunity for you to advance in the company as a partner?
Yeah, I mean, that was a time, and I've been in the company for long enough, I think 6-7 years, and it was 1995, and I remember that year especially because that's the same year I became U.S. citizen. And there was an opportunity, and there was a few partners in the firm before, and I was called in for a meeting, and they said, "We are wonderful. We are happy with your work, and here's what we like to offer." And I was stand still, and I said, "That's thank you very much. I appreciate it, but why it is this number? Why it is this low?" Because the other people,
what was low? Your share of the business?
Yeah, they were offering the share of the business because I mean, I was. Intrigued. I was reading in those days, as happened to be reading a book, is called The Power of Precedent. And I just walked in and I said, I'm doing a lot more than the other people who are existing partner. I am bringing in more revenue. I'm bringing in more client base. And I'm intrigued to hear why you're not offering me, well, you're offering me one-tenth of what they are being offered. And I said, I can tell you, if you look at my short record in this company, I think I'm a better producer than everybody combined, and that I did not point out, including the two people who were talking to me.
Wow.
And I said, why is that? And they did not have any answer for me. And one of them finally asked me, he said, well, we're concerned about you, that how are you going to pay for it? I said, you know what? Leave it up to me. I figured out so many things in life, and I'll figure it out.
How are you going to pay for your share?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, it's my issue. It's not your issue. But at least I wanted to be respected. To me, this was a matter of simple recognition, which in my mind I deserve. I have brought in the value to the company in a real hard dollars, and I wanted to have somebody recognize me. Because before that, it was, to me, it was fun and game. If somebody make a derogatory remark, I just let it brush off, and I said, I'm a better person than that. I don't need to answer it. That's what my parent always told me. And I said, I'm not going to get into these, you know, conversation in the mud.
Did you ever think of quitting the company during that period?
No, never. Because it's a very special company.
Did you convince them to give you a larger share?
Well, the conversation finished as they said they will get back to me.
Okay.
And they got back to me 3 days later and they said, okay, we got it.
Okay.
You got what you're asking.
And you continue to move up in DDG.
I never threatened to leave because that's not the answer.
We're going to take a break here in the conversation, Mr. Rashid. Asen Rashid, who is CEO and president of DDG here in Baltimore, a design firm, international design firm. He gave a speech called The Cultural Boogeyman in the Closet, How Corporate Fear of Diversity Undermines Economic Success. That's why we asked him to come on the show today to talk about this. And we'll hear more of his story when we get back. And if you'd like to join our conversation, maybe some of what Mr. Rashid has to say rings a bell with you. You've had a similar experience or faced similar situation in your workplace in the corporate world. 410-662-8780. Dan Rodericks here. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. We're talking about workplace discrimination, I guess, in a different way today. Asen Rashid speaking about it in terms of how it hurts the bottom line of American companies. He is a Pakistan-born president and CEO of DDG, a design and architecture firm, an international company that's based here in Baltimore, in the Canton section of Baltimore. Now, there came a time, Mr. Rashid, when you had an actual opportunity to become president of the company, right?
Yes. I mean, we had some, you know, corporate agreements in place in a various partnership sector that the majority owners who were in existence from the early on, they need to kind of a dial down and they need to reduce their ownership so the younger generation can pick it up. And some were corporate funded, some were personal funded. A combination of things, and so that there was a hard deadline, which was the December of 2010, and that was the date in which that transition, which was slowly moving on for a long time, had to take place. So, and that was interesting because that was the kind of the worst economic time, which started in 2008 for a business like ours. So we were in this conundrum that how are we going to do this transition, because those stock shares in a real world has to be paid. And there were a series of people who were so-called on the top management, like a senior partner, so I was one of them, need to be eligible, and there's a certain process in place through the board of director and recognition and accreditation that those things has to be transacted. So, yeah, that was the time. And there was a certain shares I owned, and the certain shares people other own. And then we had this block of shares which were coming up for sale. So whoever gets this basically gets the majority. And I was one of the contenders along with many other. And there was a lot of politicking going on, and there was a lot of comment and innuendos being made. And as I mentioned, that even though I was a top producer in the company for ages, or as I say, use the word, I opened up DDG's Chinese business. I opened up DDG's Indian business. I was active in doing Indonesia. I was building, I was really bringing in, I would say, 80 to 90% of the revenue of the company. In some years, like 2008, I was bringing in literally 100% of the revenue of the company. Right. So it was really practical.
May I say, it sounds like in that period of time, you were doing your best to save the company.
Because
the company needed to needed to expand and, and work in other nations, right?
Absolutely.
So is that when the expansion came to India and China?
Yeah. I mean, we were I would just say, very fortunate that we got invited by a Chinese developer, and which was, I see, as we always see, a great opportunity, a golden opportunity in a big country. We got into China in year 2000, really on the bottom end of the curve, as they say, and we were trying to raise it as the other company. And in the meantime, I was just flying one day with one of my colleagues who was originally from New Delhi. And Raj and I were sitting in the plane, and I said to him, Raj, and we had a good trip, and I said, wouldn't that be wonderful? We are already working in a country which is a billion people, and everybody buys from China, and look, they're buying from us. We are selling Maryland business, and we are a small company, and we are bringing dollars from China to pay to our employee.
Right.
Wouldn't that be fun that let's go and see if we can get into India, another billion people there? And he was very, because he was in India, so we made some calls, and I had some contacts, and one thing led to the other. Within 1 year, we got some contracts signed in India.
Some design contracts in India as well.
So we're doing quite a lot of projects there.
Go back to your bid to become the president of the company.
It was an interesting. I had a lunch with our, at that time, the shareholder, and we had a lot of politicking going on. And one day I was thinking that, you know, this is going to ruin the company I love dear and near to my heart, and I helped to build it so much. Other people were also
helping. Going to ruin the company?
If we don't go through a proper transition, because I could sense the people who brought it up, and there were a lot of people looking for different agendas and different objectives. And I had my agenda, and I wanted to build a company. I was very serious stuff, and there are a lot of jobs on the line. I mean, we don't want to get engaged. And this is a company I love dear, and I travel and I tell people they don't really know how well this company is known globally. And
DDG, based
DDG.
Here in Baltimore, which I'm repeating again for our listeners.
They
don't know about your company.
I mean,
by the way, we didn't cover all of the growth. How many employees did DDG have by the time of this transition that we're talking about?
The transition we had around mid-80s.
So it had grown considerably.
Were, as I said, when I joined, it was around 17 people. We'd gone exponentially. We were growing like 200, 300% people a year. At some time, we are larger than, and we have come to traction because of the business climate and other ways, which is a normal thing for any businesses.
Okay. So what happened to your bid?
My bid was not as wonderfully taken as I expected, because my offer was actually very generous in my mind. And I was thinking one day, how could I do my part to keep this thing together from exploding? So I went to the CEO, and I said, you know, I have a suggestion. We know we are in tough economic times, and we can't fund this transition through the company funds. And I have an idea. And he said, what's the idea? I said, I'll fund it myself with my personal money. And he said, are you serious? I said, yeah, of course I'm serious. So I basically drafted a letter night before, which was my own version, which my attorney told me later on, you're the most idiot person in the world. Why didn't you consult with me? But it was a lot of emotion, a lot of love involved. And I told him, I'll pay you. This is the amount. I put the dollar amount, and I will like you to continue to be the CEO because you're a great leader. I like you to continue to be our president, and I will give you you'll continue to have a voting seat in the board. And I given it to him. We had a great lunch at a restaurant, and I said, take it. He said, let me think about it. I say, okay. A week later, he comes back to me. He said, I can't accept that. And I said, what's the reason? He said, it's going to break the company apart. I said, what do you think that way? I said, I'm afraid that if you don't do that, it's going to break the company apart. And he said, well, the others, in quote-unquote, cannot accept you as the leader. And I said, how so? And I said, you do know what my contributions are. Everybody know what my contributions are. And how do you think it would be taken? He said, they will never accept you their leader, and let's not talk about it. I said, okay, let's not talk about it. Because I did not push the matter, because I knew the time is on my side. I don't need to be impatient, because within 3 months, the legal clock start to tick, and we have to take an action forcibly, and hopefully board will move. So I just said, okay, fine. If you don't like my offer, it's fine. So I went back and do what I do. You know, I was running the company, doing the business, but within a couple of months, it happened exactly what I knew was going to happen, that there was a letter issued to the board that these share has to be transacted, and people were looking around, and I knew it was coming, because it was pretty much like a clock. I mean, you have to go through the procedure. You can't just, it's not a fun and game anymore. Mm-hmm. So we gone through the process, and I said, okay. I spoke to him privately. I said, can I bring my bid back now? And he said, sure, because he does not have any alternative. So I put my bid back, and we had a lot of politicking, and in the meantime, a lot of feelings got hurt of people who thought I shouldn't be where I needed to, wanted to go, because I said, well, it's a free country. It's the biggest country. And I use always say the reason which brought me to this United States is it's the land of opportunity. And everybody has the equal opportunity. This is the best place in the world which anybody can think of. And that is what I love, this place. And I said, you have the equal opportunity that I do. Put your bid on the table if you really believe it. As the old saying go, in a grunt way, you know, put your money where your mouth is.
Right.
And I said, bring it on, and please, let's talk to the board. It's the board's decision. But they did not want it to do what I think needs to happen, for whatever reasons, a lot of complex issues. And finally, board decided I was the only contender, and they ratified my bid and towards moving to the corporate transaction.
Did you become president and CEO immediately?
It took a while. It took a while to...
Okay. The previous CEO, the one who was in place at that time, referred to the others, meaning other partners in the company. What happened to the others?
The others, the day I became CEO, they came to me one by one, starting at, I remember still, it was a Friday. It was because we had the transaction on 14th of April, and next day was the tax day. It was a Friday, and they came to me one at a time, starting at 3 o'clock, 3:15, and 3:30, and same letter of resignation. And I basically asked them to stay and work with me and to build a better company, and they said, no, we have decided we're going to leave. And they left.
Asin Rashid, president and CEO of DDG, the design and architectural firm that is based in Baltimore. Why did they quit? And do you suspect it has to do with who you are, your nation of origin?
I think it's a complex...
Your ethnicity.
I believe it has a certain percentage to do with that. I think it's a long... complex subject. It's not only the race. Race is probably a part of it, because I heard kind of innuendos and comments that you could do business in China and you can bring in business from India, but you can never work in or bring in work out of a USA. Or you could be successful in other parts of the world, which is third world countries, but you can never work in Western world, or mm-hmm. nobody will listen to you. And I just sort of, you know, did not let it get to me.
So they resigned rather than find out whether this would work out.
Yes.
And let me just ask you this question, Mr. Rashid. How do you know it wasn't just a personality conflict? I mean, or maybe that was part of it. You concede that might have been part of it or not?
I think it has... a combination of a lot of things, I believe. But when you hear comments such as hinted to the quote-unquote color of my skin, mm-hmm. verbally put on my face, I mean, it's hard to take that out of the equation.
Yes, I agree. I want to ask you what happened next. You became eventually president and CEO of DGG. As you sit here today, you hold those titles. How has the company done in the 4 years since this transaction?
We are doing, with the blessing of God, wonderful. We are very fortunate. I have a amazing group of partners. I have some very close-knit friendship with partners and who are my inner circle of advisors. We talk about everything. To me, is nothing is off the chart. Everything is on the table to how we're going to make a better company.
Do you believe you've changed the culture of the company?
I think I'm one of the people. I wouldn't say everybody, but I believe I'm one of the people who are leading the charge to change the culture, how DDG needs to be.
How diverse is the culture at DDG?
Our team is built up more than 20 people from 20 different countries. We have speaks 26 plus languages. We just joke about it. We speak anything from A to Z, from Arabic all the way to Zulu and anything in between. We are very blessed. We are very blessed. I feel very, very blessed that I have a great friends and who are my partners, who are my advisors, and who take a lot of burden off my shoulders. And I trust them without any question because they believe in the same mission.
DDG was the site of a symposium that was hosted by, well, you hosted a symposium put on by the international this international group on cultural diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And that's where you made your remarks in this speech whose title I gave earlier, mm-hmm. The Cultural Boogeyman in the Closet, How Corporate Fear of Diversity Undermines Economic Success.
Correct.
And I read the speech. I enjoyed it. And there's something in there, though, I wanted to ask you about. You said that as an immigrant and as a newcomer in this company, especially being an immigrant, that you had to work harder, work many extra hours to compensate for, I forget exactly how you put it here. You just felt like the message was, work as hard as you can because you have to compensate for the fact that you're not from here. You're not from the United States.
Correct. It was very, not only symbolically, but it was told to me on my face. Mm-hmm. That, that's the true statement was you have to work twice as hard to get half the credit because you're not Caucasian.
Here's the quote. I'm sorry, I meant to find this earlier. You're not white, so you're going to have to work twice as hard to get half the respect and credit that a white person would.
Correct.
Someone gave you that advice.
Yeah, and that I was not the only one he given that advice to, but this advice was given to several of my foreign colleagues.
All right. And then I wanted to ask you about this. Did you find eventually that you were working so hard, putting in extra hours, whatever you were doing, that people came to resent that you were working so hard, you were setting an example that they couldn't match?
I sensed that because I was not the person, because then some of the tide changed when I was started to produce results. And then you can't just, stretch it too much and just not get noticed. And then I start to get a little bit better quality projects to do, and those projects would start to win design awards. I mean, that is a lot of pride we take in DDG. We have won more than 166 international design awards and accolade, which gives us a new client base. So that was getting resentful that I was working so hard, and I was I was there 24/7 and I haven't gone home for 2-3 days, and because the job needs to be done.
But that provokes some resentment.
Yes, it does. And basically was, I was sort of feel like a lot of time certain people were stopped talking to me. Hmm. And then I just sort of brushed it off. I said, they'll get back around. And they're being just childish.
You say in your speech, in a country where we pay lip service to a strong work ethic, if you're from another country, your hard work creates a cultural divide.
Yes, and that is something which I start to sense, because I start to feel that I did what I think needs to be done. I was not looking for any gold star on my forehead. I believe there are promises made to the clients which are very sacred, and we need to produce the project. We need to project in the best possible way. They're paying us to do the job. I'm not wanting any recognition. We need to do what we are paid to do. It's no more complicated than that. And we need to provide the best service and in the true and honest way to do our job. But when I was doing that job, and if a job is due on a Friday and I need to make sure it gets out on Friday, this means I need to budget my time and all those things. So others, people, I need to feel like I'm trying to compensate for a lot of people who were not there. And they basically start to say, well, I heard them being in the back. Oh, give it to him. He will take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine. the more the opportunity, because I was not there for a short run. I'm not going to quit because I knew it will be okay. I just believe that. I still believe things will be fine.
And you believed in the company. You said, you used the word love earlier. You said you actually loved the company and
it's the most amazing company I think it exists.
We're going to get to the main part of your message after a short break here. Asin Rashid, president and CEO of DDG, the design and architectural firm based in Baltimore, the message about diversity in the corporate world. And there needs to be more of it, less resistance to it, because actually it's not just hurting feelings, it's hurting bottom lines. We'll take a break here on Midday and come back. You're welcome to join us with a comment or question about what you've heard so far from our conversation with Asin Rashid, 410-662-8780. This is Midday. And welcome back to Midday, our conversation with Asin Rashid from DDG over in Canton. How many different countries did you say you worked in now? 53 countries?
53 countries
including a possible development in Iraq, in Kurdistan?
Yes, we are actually working in Kurdistan.
Oh, so you're doing it. Can you just tell us a little bit about the nature of the project?
There are two projects which we are doing, and one of them, there's a local Kurdish developer who retained us, and we are doing a large residential project. And we are involved in redoing their corporate identity. This is a company which is a very large established Kurdish company, and we started to talk to them about their organization. They are redoing the company. So we are doing their rebranding of this whole organization, new identity, new messaging, new logos, new everything. So we are really creating the branding and diversity and identity of the company. And then we're doing a master planning, landscape architecture, signage and graphics, environmental branding, and lighting design for a very large project.
You know, in the narrative of DDG, as you laid it out here, presented it to us during this hour of the show, it sounds like there was a struggle about what the business model was going to be for the company, whether its reach was going to continue to be international, especially India and China, with you as its head, or was the company going to take a more domestic course in the United States? If I'm wrong about that, correct me, but it sounds like that was part of the struggle and the friction.
There was. I think the friction was to get hold of the company's direction, and I had certain way I wanted to. For instance, I'll give you an example. You talk about diversity earlier. Is that the heart and soul of any company like us, which is a creative studio, are the talent. It's not a brick-and-mortar building. It's a talent. It's that who are the creative brains behind the company? How do those people think? Do you have people who are innovators, who are thinking better than your competitors thinking? So we are challenged by the talent, which basically makes us who we are. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking for talent, that is where diversity plays a lot of big role, because we are, as I said, equal opportunity employer. Not only by law, but we basically have no biases of any kind. Doesn't matter where the talent come from, who they are, what language they speak, color, sex, origin. We look at their resume, look at their work, and we basically make decision because our life depend on it. So we never question anything, but there's a lot of people who basically does not believe in the same format.
Globalization is not new. It's not new to American companies. American companies have not made this adjustment as far as you can tell from what you see. Is that why you're delivering this message around?
Right. I mean, American companies a lot in a major way. They are, I mean, for instance, you know, we lost our manufacturing base, pretty major. We lost our financial base in this country. And we have lost our leadership on the climate change and environment. We are basically always the naysayer on a lot of big decision in the United Nations of the world. And U.S. companies are running in a very much of a quarterly Wall Street cycle.
Right.
Which they just wanted to make sure more profit so they can get their bonuses. And that's not a long-term thinking. And when it comes to companies like DDG, we live and our steam engine is the talent. And I am doing whatever I need to do to find the best talent. Find it wherever. We go to interview to University of Maryland, for instance. We are a very big supporter. We hire from Morgan State. We have good relationship with the deans at both schools, and we talk and invite us. But the point is, a lot of things, in my opinion, which I shared with both deans, sometimes they agree and a lot of times they don't agree. I come from an employer perspective, and I tell them, this is how you need to refine and develop your curriculum, because this is the strengths I need to bring a talent pool here. And many times they listen, sometimes they don't. So I need to go and find that talent pool. And if we advertise clearly, and if I need to find a person, and I do a lot of those interviews in Beijing in a hotel lobby, and I do interviews in sitting in a hotel lobby. And recently I did a hire in Istanbul, and we are bringing in this young lady who wants to be here just for 1 year. She just found us from someplace. And I interviewed her. She's a brilliant mind and a great talent. I think it'll be a great asset for our organization. We do a lot of international hiring from the place of origin.
And you think there's resistance to this in other corporations? You see it?
Yes. A lot of resistance comes in. People, they don't, I've seen it that a lot of time when we hire, people say, oh, what's, they look at our studio. We interview them and we walk them through the studio, and I can see the some eyeballs popping when they're looking at people, or they look so different, you know? It's like, and then they, and we offer them a few times it happens that we made them an offer and they made some excuse and they didn't accept it. Some people leave the company. And I know there were some people leaving the company after I became the leader of the pack here, who basically did not agree with my methodology to look at simple, pure talent pool who needs to be brought in, because that is our survival. And we are missing, in my mind, a big global reach out, because we are, sometimes I feel like we are, some companies are retracting as compared to growing, because I need, for instance, from in my mind, or we need in our mind, a larger talent pool to grow the company. We have contract, which we can't start because I can't hire enough talent. Recently, for instance, we apply like anybody. We are hungry for talent, so we basically take sponsors, just like I got into DDG. We take sponsorships to foreign students to invite them in. So we test them out for a year, and if they're good, we apply to Immigration and Naturalization Services to become their sponsor, and we do it all the time. I have to say that it cost us tremendous amount of more time, money.
Right. Than it should.
Legal fee.
Yeah.
But as compared to hiring a U.S.-born citizen right away, and we have no resentment. I want the best talent. And we.
So when you hear the immigration debate, you hear the politics of immigration in America. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hollering that goes on, a lot of shouting over that. Mm-hmm. It's a real flashpoint still, and we still don't have immigration reform. And a recent election in Virginia. With Eric Cantor's loss, a lot of people said, it's going to make it even tougher now because Cantor seemed at least willing to make some compromises from the right. So, when you hear that, are you hearing general resistance to not only allowing people more people to come into the United States to ease up a little bit, maybe grant amnesty to those who are here already and get them on the track to citizenship, just a general resistance to foreigners? Is that how you're hearing it?
Yeah, I agree. I am somebody, people, I'm very tough to get frustrated. I have developed a lot of, as you say, thick skin and patience along the years.
Mm-hmm.
So when I listen to a lot of these people talking about a lot of things, I just say, give me a break,
Where? What? Give me a break.
Give me a break.
About
on like for instance, we have a economic battle we are running. We are in $3+ trillion in debt here. We could use literally all the help we can get. And when people are squabbling over hiring Americans, and I said, find me some American. I wanted to hire them, but the thing is, I can't find those. And people are complaining about. So I think there's a great attraction for
people
us.
People don't believe you. There are people, they find that incredulous, that you can't find talented Americans to work for DDG.
Yeah. People basically had this thing, because I heard that thing before, and I said, if you have somebody, bring them in. We have hired headhunters. Trust me. We have hired all kind of referral. We always do. People, headhunters call us all the time. I say, bring us
and
resume.
For your purposes, you haven't found people as talented as foreign students.
As foreign students. We hired people. I'm interviewing.
What is it? Is it work ethic?
No.
Or is it skill?
I think it's skills. It's skills. Primarily, our universities are changing the formats. For instance, University of Maryland, I had a conversation with the dean, and I said, your curriculum I give you an example. In a four-year architecture program, they do not let people use computer. I mean, it's hard to believe in this day and age, to draw buildings. They said, oh, well, we wanted to have people draw by hand. And I said, well, I need people who can draw by hand and draw by computer.
Right.
And they said, oh, no, we are creating tinkers. And I said, you need to produce the project. Who's going to draw?
Are they placing students in jobs?
We have hired a lot of University of Maryland students.
No, I don't mean just DDG. Are they finding jobs elsewhere for
They said they are finding jobs. And I said, wonderful, this good luck to you. But I can tell you, the jobs, what they're finding, that employer, just like we hired, need to invest so much time to train your college graduate. I don't have to do that same thing, which I find a kid from Buffalo, New York, which we hired, a very bright young Indian gentleman. And
Indian American or Indian immigrant?
Indian immigrant, and he's still on an Indian passport, and he's a delight to work with, and he is hardworking like anybody else. We have people from Savannah, Georgia, who are Chinese national. We hire them, and they come pre-trained, and they are, as I said, with a bright eyes and ambition to conquer the world. Like, I see myself in a lot of them, like I was, and we have a wonderful, wonderful team. I mean, my right-hand...
I just want to make sure I understand something. You're not looking at those students as possible employees because of your business in China and India?
Or not at
all. They could take a job... They could do any work for you.
Do any work for you. I mean, the people who are from India are working on project and actually in Latin America. They're working for projects in Columbus, Ohio. They're working on project everywhere. It's not that where they're going to put them. It's like the talent pool is so immense. I mean, my right-hand person, a great friend of mine, Valerie, I mean, she has the same ideology as I do, and she looks for operating the company. And she does the same way, looking at the same view and same mission to build the company.
Asin Rashid, we're down to our last couple of minutes together here in this hour of the show. I've enjoyed this conversation, learning about your company and your own story. What is your message to corporate America, to other CEOs who are listening?
I say, you know, we are a country. I came into the country as fundamental cliche, it could be land of opportunity. It is truly a land of opportunity. I started at the ground floor as much as possible as a junior level intern, and with my ambition, and I got there right there. I think they need to look at a bigger picture, that how they need to look at the diversity as an asset, not as a hindrance, as a liability. Visa process, they need to go into the Congress, make their case, and to say we need to stop worrying about these quotas on the visas. We are lack of the talent in this company, in this country. We need to hire talent and appreciate the talent as we're worrying about the quotas on the visas and how many foreigners we're going to get or not get.
Asin Rashid is the president and CEO of DDG, the international design and architectural firm based in Canton in Baltimore here. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show, and thank you for this message and this conversation.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very delighted that you've given me this opportunity and to listen to your audience, to talk to your audience.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rashid, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our first hour of midday. Please stay tuned. We have another hour coming up. We're going to take a break now for lunch, provided by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market at 1900 North Broadway in Baltimore. Please stay tuned for the news and then the second hour of our show.